Live from America's finest city, this is Real Talk San Diego on ESPN 1700. And now, your hosts, Ryan White and David McKelvin.
Welcome and happy Thursday. With us today in studio, the barefoot lawyer himself, Ethan Marcus. Marcus Family Law Center is a certified family law specialist. And as I mentioned, the website, barefootlawyer.com. That's his website, barefootlawyer.com. Offices, three of them, right? San Diego, Riverside, and Imperial. Covering the, what would it be, central to Southern California area.
Yeah, three main offices, and then we also have some affiliates.
Wow, wonderful. So, Ethan, as I mentioned, certified family law specialist. We're going to talk about tax impacts of various aspects of divorce, child support deductions versus tax deductions, equalizing payment with a certain number of years tax-free. A lot of divorce tax stuff, right? I mean, that's just what it boils down to.
Yes.
Ethan has in here in his notes that tax planning can sound dull, but cash is always exciting. And definitely, cash is very exciting. With us as well, here to make tax planning not dull, Jackie Jarrett. She is a tax accountant with Hamilton Tharp. Their website is HT2CPA.com. That's the website, HT2CPA.com. She brought with us today the 12 tax saving tips you must know before year end. 12 of them, huh?
Yes.
Is that it? No more than 12? There's no 13?
Oh, there are several.
Okay, these so this is like the best 12.
Yes.
The best 12. Okay, we boiled it down to just 12, and it's December, you know, ish, 4th. Is it too late?
No, it's not too late.
Phew. Okay, good. Well, we're going to talk with Ethan about how exactly divorce and separation is going to have a variety of different tax consequences. And you brought up a variety of things before the show that kind of discussed how child support can have some effect on the tax situation. But how that plays conversely, meaning the tax situation can have some effect on the child support. And it's really the latter that's more important.
Well, I wouldn't ascribe one more importance than the other. The greatest importance is money in your pocket. I am really excited about this particular show. You've had me on before, but I love the fact that we have a tax professional on here because I am not a tax professional. And we are taught from the very beginning to steer our clients to tax professionals. But we're also taught to look for tax issues that are going to impact our issues, which is what I'm here to talk about. So, yeah, it's absolutely true. When you're calculating support, there are things called guideline deductions from your income. Guideline deductions aren't always the same as tax deductions. And so you might end up in a situation where you maximize your tax deductions and you say, wow, I have saved a lot of money at Uncle Sam's expense, only to find out that you have a whopping child support bill that is enforced by the Department of Child Support Services. They always call it services, right? Internal Revenue Services. Service means that they want your money and they have a way to get it.
Well, let's back up just a second. So we're obviously talking about going through divorce, right? I mean, laying the ground rules. That is what we're talking about and how we split up the stuff. Right.
It can be that. There are many ways that you can jointly own things, and there's also, believe it or not, ways to create children without getting married. And that can also yield child support consequences. But generally, we can call it divorce. We're talking about a separation. Of a couple of people that used to commingle their lives in some way are now going to be separate in some way.
Got it. That makes sense. And you mentioned how it was a really good analogy how when and how things get foggy, misunderstood, complicated when one of the spouses gets remarried and the new spouse has a big income. Kind of walk us through that scenario because I think it's a really good one to lay the ground rules of how important tax is in this whole situation.
All right, so an example I gave as if if someone were to marry someone who was very well-to-do, like a Bill or a Melinda Gates, and there's an out person who says, I want child support from this person. And now I think I'm going to get a lot of child support because my ex is a Gates. And what they find out is, no, that's not true. And the reason why is, in calculating support, what they always tell you is the new spouse does not have to support the old children. So their income doesn't count. But the fact is, it does count. It counts for tax purposes, which is where your tax professional comes in. So one of the things about marrying a billionaire is that billionaires are taxed at a higher rate. And if they're taxed at a higher rate, so are their spouses. So the more money this new spouse makes, the, get this, less money your ex makes. And that's because their piddly salary is being taxed at a billionaire's rate, and therefore the child support is less, or if you're the one paying child support, your child support is higher because they quote unquote have less money.
Interesting impact. Yeah, the opposite of what most people would guess.
That's right.
I would imagine every time that that happens, you end up answering that question.
That's right. And well, I can do it in the abstract in the way that I just did, but you don't know what the situation most advantageous to the client is unless you've got a team going. So I can recognize the issue, but that's why you have to have a partnership with a tax professional.
Got it. We're talking with Ethan Marcus. His website, barefootlawyer.com. He's a certified family law specialist. Again, his website, barefootlawyer.com. So you've got some examples here, and we talked a little bit about child support, and we're going to come back to that as well. But let's talk about the alimony. And this is, of course, in separated families and the financial planning that goes behind that. You've got a variety of bullet points here based on alimony.
All right. So let's say you're divorcing and you're splitting up property. There's all kinds of tax issues involved with that. For example, if one person gets more property than the other, then someone has to pay what's called an equalizing payment. Equalizing payment are usually tax-free for a period of years. The number of years that it's presumed to be an equalizing payment and therefore tax-free, I don't remember, but maybe Jackie does.
Why would somebody get more than the other?
It's very simple. If you have property, let's say you have one house and a bank account.
Okay.
The house is worth $200,000. The bank account is worth $10,000. Short of drawing a yellow line down the middle of the house, someone is going to get the house and someone is going to get the bank account.
Okay.
The difference between $200,000 and $10,000, stay with me, is $190,000. So the person that got more has to pay half the difference, which would be $95,000.
Got it.
$95,000 is a tax-free event. But someone who wants to pay $95,000 may want it to not be tax-free. They may want a deduction for that. So there's a way to do that. You can characterize it as spousal support arrears or alimony. But if your alimony payments drop precipitously over a three-year period, there's a thing called recapture, which again, your tax professional can tell you about. So if I pay $95,000 in 1 year and call it spousal support and try to deduct it, and the following year I pay zero, that's a precipitous drop and there's going to be some recapture. So that's one issue with regards to alimony. This is going beyond and creatively thinking beyond just the monthly support that everyone's used to.
Sure.
It's taking advantage of tax codes to try to craft a good settlement. All right, so the other thing you need to worry about is spousal support is terminable on death, whereas equalizing payments are not. So equalizing payments, if you owe it, you owe it, and if you pass away, your estate owes it. Spousal support, you pass away and the debt disappears. If you characterize it as arrears as opposed to current support, you might get around that, but it's something you need to worry about.
So let's say that one more time because that's an interesting distinction between the two. Go through those just one more time.
Okay. So spousal support is terminable on death. In order for it to be deductible, that's actually one of the requirements of the Internal Revenue Code. I'll actually cite it, IRC 71. Again, I have a tax professional here who will correct me if I'm wrong. But one of the things that it's required to make a tax deductible is that it be terminable on the death of the recipient. It happens to be that in California, spousal support is generally terminable on death of either person.
Okay.
Right. So even though we think of it as a debt and we think of debts as surviving death, just as property does, spousal support is generally an exception. Child support is not. So those are things that you have to bear in mind. It's not so much just is something tax deductible or is something not. A lot of times something is tax deductible if it fits in a number of categories and looks like a particular thing. And that's where the details come in. And that's actually the stuff that I know.
But with respect to equalizing payments,
yes,
that is a debt that would stick with the estate should either party, I think you said, pass away.
That is correct.
Would have not expected that. Okay, we're talking with Ethan Marcus, Marcus Family Law Center. He's a certified family law specialist. His website is barefootlawyer.com. That's his website, barefootlawyer.com. We've talked about kind of how to use, well, the tax implications in drafting the separation and, you know, different ways to really follow the money to, well, keep the most in your pocket and really to be able to calculate what you're going to be able to keep in your pocket, which I know you've said a lot of times, seek a tax professional, and that is the end result thing to do. But in directing that, it seems like you got a pretty good understanding of what you're going to end up looking at with respect to, like, for example, equalizing payments.
Yeah, I would hope so. You know, the court, there's a rule called the Fonstein rule, which is the court can only look at tax consequences that are immediate and specific. We as attorneys, on the other hand, are not limited to that. And if we only limit ourselves to that, then our malpractice carriers may raise our rates. So, for example, let's say I get the house and someone else gets a $300,000 bank account. Okay. That's okay. And my house is worth $300,000. So that sounds like an equal division. But it might not be, because when the house sells, what are the taxes going to be? Has anyone figured out what the basis on the house is, what the gain on the house is going to be? Whereas the money in the bank is probably post-tax. Is the house appreciating? Is the money in the bank depreciating due to inflation? Can an attorney figure those things out? Absolutely. Can an attorney figure those things out with the assistance of a professional? Even better. I don't know if that answered your question, but that's the kind of stuff we think about.
Excellent. One more time. Certified Family Law Specialist Ethan Marcus, Marcus Family Law Center, the website barefootlawyer.com. That's the website barefootlawyer.com. When we come back, we're going to talk with Jackie Jarrett, tax accountant with Hamilton Tharp, and begin our list of the 12 tax saving tips you must know before year end. Ahead of us, we come back. Welcome back. We've been talking with Ethan Marcus, Certified Family Law Specialist, Marcus Family Law Center, the website barefootlawyer.com. That's the website, barefootlawyer.com. I'm going to shift gears a little bit and get into the 12 tax saving tips you must know before the year's end. We're here with Jackie Jarrett, tax accountant with Hamilton Tharp. Jackie, you have on your list, and I did ask you ahead of time, these 12, they're in numerical order for a reason, right? You have at the top of your list health care mandates. What does that mean?
Well, the Affordable Care Act established coverage requirements beginning after December 31st, 2013. So for the 2014 tax year, everyone needs to have minimum essential health care coverage. Most plans meet these requirements, but if you're not sure, you should contact your plan administrator or insurance provider directly. But not having coverage for every month in the year of 2014 could mean that you would be subject to a penalty on your tax return for this year. That's probably the most questions that we've been dealing with in the past couple months is how these healthcare mandates are going to affect individuals' tax returns.
So how much penalty, when does the penalty hit, if they have to pay the penalty, that kind of stuff?
Yes.
Yes. And is it commonly worth it to pay the penalty?
I don't want to give my opinion on whether or not you should pay the penalty.
The penalty
is going to increase in 2015, and then it's going to increase again in 2016.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're comparing the cost of the penalty to the cost of having health insurance, I'm not going to give you my opinion on that. Although the cost of not having health insurance if something catastrophic happens, of course, is more than the penalty that you're going to pay.
Got it. Got it. Okay. So get health insurance. And is there, so if you do it by the end of this year, and how does that, how does, I guess it's going to get you out of penalties in the future, right? Is that the idea?
Well, if you're covered. So every
month. Of course.
Yeah. Every month that you're covered, you're not subject to the penalty. Every month that you're not covered, unless you qualify for one of the exemptions, mm-hmm. then you will need to pay the penalty.
Got it.
So it's on a monthly basis.
Right. So potentially if I ran out and got it in December, I might have 11 months of paying penalty.
Correct.
There's just nothing I can do about that.
Yes.
That's how it goes. Okay.
Unless you qualify for an exception.
Of course. Of course. There's an exception to every rule, right?
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about net investment income tax, NIIT.
Okay. So this isn't a new tax. It was implemented in 2013. It's an additional 3.8% tax that's applied to high-income taxpayers with modified adjusted gross income, sorry for the jargon, over $200,000 for single individuals and over $250,000 for married joint filing couples.
Now, is this what people were referring to as the Obama tax?
It's one of the
one of, right. Right. We find this a lot, I think, we find this a lot happening in real estate. For the sales
yes.
of properties, right?
Yes.
That's how it was popping up. So you said more than three numbers in a sentence, which means we have to go back and kind of refine that again.
Okay.
Talk to me again about net investment income tax. Let's go through that one more time because it's complicated.
Okay. So if your gross income is over $200,000 and you're a single individual or over $250,000, you're married filing joint, you're going to be subject to this net investment income tax, this 3.8% tax on investment income. It applies to taxable interest, dividends, capital gains, rental income, regardless of participation, and passive income from a trade or a business in which you do not participate. Of course, anything that's passive is going to be subject to net investment income tax.
$200,000 for single,
mm-hmm.
$250,000 for married, an additional 3.5% tax.
Essentially.
Yeah. This year, first, well, 2013 you said
2013 was the first year. Mm-hmm. The reason I think it's important to bring it up again is so many people were shocked by their tax bills. And they said, what is this new net investment income tax? The tax brackets already went up to 39%.
Okay.
For high income earners. So this net investment income tax, or I'm sorry, this net investment income tax, NIIT, what we refer, actually means a higher than advertised tax rate. So your 39% plus your 3.8% plus another, what you can refer to an Obamacare tax of 0.9%.
Wow, put you at 43 and change, 44 mm-hmm. there pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And so what might someone do this year to avoid that tax? I say that as if there's a way of avoiding it, but let's just go ahead and assume that there is.
Well, some ideas to reduce your net investment income tax include converting some of your taxable investments to tax-exempt securities, such as muni bonds.
Okay.
Another suggestion is a lot of high-income earners donate a good amount of money to charity. One thing you can do is you can donate your securities that have appreciated directly to a charitable organization, rather than selling it, paying tax on the capital gain, and then making the donation.
I see. So really getting rid of the $200,000 to $250,000 income is the way you get out of the tax.
Yeah.
Show less money.
Yeah, show less money.
Show less money. Now, that's kind of going to be the goal for a lot of these, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Show less money. California College Access Credit.
Okay, so this is a new California tax credit. It's available for the tax years 2014 through 2016. It's for taxpayers who make a cash contribution to the College Access Tax Credit Fund and who receive a credit certification from the California Educational Facilities Authority. The only reason I want to point this out is if you make the contribution without getting the certificate, then it doesn't qualify for the credit. So you want to make sure you apply to take the credit.
Okay. So I'm donating money? Is that what I'm doing?
Okay. So the fund is used to support an existing program that provides education grants to low-income college students. So you are donating money. On the federal side, it's a charitable deduction. You can deduct 100%. On the California side, you can claim 60% of the contribution as a credit. Now, credits are dollar for dollar. Deductions on the federal side are going to be whatever your effective tax rate is. So if you donate $1,000, your effective tax rate is 20% on the federal side, then you're going to get a $200 benefit on the federal side. On the California side, you're going to get a $600 benefit. It's dollar for dollar.
Interesting. And so that's why you bring this up, because we all know we can give our money away to a variety of charities and get mm-hmm. a write-off, but that write-off is in the form of a deduction most commonly, as opposed to a dollar-for-dollar credit.
Yes.
Here. And are there any limitations?
Yeah. So on the California side, it's important to note.
Say, I was feeling really charitable this year. Want to know how much I can contribute?
It is only a 60%. You only get 60%. Credit for the contribution.
Right.
For 2015, it's only 55%. For 2016, it's 50%. But one thing I wanted to bring up is I did a recent tax planning project for a client who needed to pay an additional $30,000 to cover his state tax. If he paid it by December 31st, he gets the deduction on his federal return. State taxes are not deductible on the California return. So we did two scenarios. We did one where the $30,000 was made for the state tax payment and one where it was made towards the college access credit. What ended up happening is it was more advantageous for him to make the state tax payment. If he were to have put that $30,000 as a contribution to the college access credit, he would have been paying $5,000 more out of pocket. So everyone's tax situation is different. While a credit appears very appealing on the outside, it might not be the best move to make.
We're talking with Jackie Jarrett. She's a tax accountant with Hamilton Tharp, talking about the 12 tax-saving tips you must know before year's end. Of most recent, we're talking about the California College Access Credit. One more time, California College Access Credit, and how it's different than just simply receiving a deduction, in that you can receive a credit for up to, as you said, 60% of mm-hmm. donated. Is there a cap on the amount you're able to donate?
There are, and there will be through 2015 and through 2016.
There's always a cap.
Got it. We will see if it is reached, though.
Okay, got it. I do see how that's uniquely different than giving my money to some local charity. I mean, mm-hmm. is that kind of dipping into those resources that people would have given to, let's say, Helen Woodward or Arnold Peter, or you name it, because you're only able to get a deduction for that, right?
Correct. We don't know how it's going to impact other charities. We will see after this year. And I'm not sure how many people are going to even know about this credit for the 2014 tax year.
Right.
Plus, there's an application process. And so people who do not go through the application process won't even qualify to take the credit.
You have to qualify to give your money away?
Yes.
Well, that's a new one. Okay.
Isn't it?
Is it a difficult process?
I don't think it's a difficult process, although
so
I have not gone through it yet because we haven't found it to be an advantage for any of our clients yet.
Okay. It has not worked yet.
When we find that it works, then
okay.
I will know.
So it's not drastically shifting money away from other philanthropic efforts at the moment?
Not at the moment.
Okay, good to know. We're talking with Jackie Jarrett, tax accountant with Hamilton Tharp, talking about the 12 tax-saving tips you must know before year end. We talked about the first three: healthcare mandates, net investment income tax, and the California College Access Credit. When we come back, we're going to hear more from Ethan Marcus, more about the impact of separation and taxes ahead of us when we come back.
Go.
Well, Welcome back. We've been talking with Jackie Jarrett, tax accountant with Hamilton Tharp, talking about the 12 tax-saving tips you must know before year-end. Their website, HT2CPA.com, HT2CPA.com. We talked about healthcare mandates, net investment income tax, and California College Access Credit. And we're going to come back to as many as we can get through before time is up. We will come back to that. We are going to switch gears over to Ethan Marcus, Certified Family Law Specialist with Marcus Family Law Center. We're going to talk about division of pension plans and IRAs.
Okay. So what's cool is I'm actually looking at Jackie's list, and I see that like three of her points deal with that and talking about maximizing contributions for retirement and otherwise sheltering your income for the future. And that is a great plan for an intact family. It can also be a great plan for a family that is in transition. But if you've invested in that great plan, you want to make sure you preserve it. So if we're a divorcing couple, and one person has invested in a retirement plan, and now we're splitting it in half, because that's what often happens, you have to do it in a way that qualifies under federal law. And if you don't, then the person who is getting their half from the pension plan ends up paying the full tax and penalties on the entire thing. There is an order called a Qualified Domestic Relations Order, and it has to meet certain requirements and have magic fairy dust language. And if it has that magic fairy dust language, then it qualifies. And the
what is the acronym for qualified domestic, whatever you just said?
It's a QDRO, and we pronounce it quadro.
Got it.
For no good reason.
Okay.
So the fun thing about pension plans is not only tax avoidance, which is an art, as opposed to tax evasion, which is a crime. The cool thing about that is that these plans are also immune to creditors. So to give you a very, very serious example, O.J. Simpson had a $37 million, I believe, dollar judgment against him for the wrongful death of a couple of people. And a lot of people wondered how he survived with that kind of debt. And the answer is because his NFL pension was exempt from collections. So he was able to draw that pension and not have to pay on the judgment.
Famous for that. Yeah. That, I mean, not only the wrongful death, but the pension plan. That was a famous test case.
So as an attorney, I'm not going to recommend engaging in criminal acts. But I will say that it is advantageous to have your money in pension plans and deferred compensation plans. And even if you're not the one who earned them, but nevertheless are getting a portion of it by virtue of being married to a person who earned them, it's a worthy investment, and you want to make sure the division is done properly.
Makes sense. And one of the ways of doing it is with the quadro.
Yeah, that is the way to do it.
That is the only way to do it.
Well, I won't say that. Some pensions are public, like California State Teachers Retirement System. They have their own division orders that are mandated by the government. Those are not called quadros, but we call them quadros.
Okay, good enough. It says Ethan Marcus, Certified Family Law Specialist, his website, barefootlawyer.com. That's his website, barefootlawyer.com. Now, we have a couple different places we're going to skip to, but I want to talk about this. Award of debts to one party. That's, you have number six here on your list. There's a way of shifting debts from one to the other?
Oh, well, that's exactly right. So let's say I get the house, and the house is worth $300,000. And the other person, to whom I used to be married, gets assets valued at $100,000. So now there's this $200,000 difference. And lo and behold, magic of magic, there are $200,000 in debt. So one of the ways to equalize this is I might take the house and $200,000 in debt. The other person walks away with $100,000 in cash. So is that an equal division? A judge would say yes. A tax preparer might say not necessarily.
Something different.
Yeah, depends on the basis in the house. You're paying those debts off with interest and on post-tax with post-tax funds. That may not be equal at all from a financial planning perspective. So it's not as simple as math that mom and dad can do at the kitchen table. That's why you want to actually project these things into the future and don't rely on the judge to do it, because the judge ain't going to do it.
Yeah, you bring that up a lot. The judge ain't going to do it.
Yeah, the judge is precluded from doing it. There's actually a law against it. And so if ever there were an argument for people to cooperate in their family transitions to other forms, this is it, because it's money in your pocket. And there's no point in fighting each other over it, because it only costs you both.
Hmm. Any people, do many people take that advice?
If they have good lawyers, they do. Because the lawyers will talk to their clients about the cost of going to court as opposed to the benefit of coming to an agreement. Obviously, there are situations when emotions run high when people are thinking of benefits that are not financial,
right?
That come from quote unquote winning in court. When that happens, of course, there's no choice. But here I am in the comfort of a studio, and we're talking about maximizing financial benefits. And so that's the pitch.
Okay, what about bankruptcy? How is that involved in the separation process?
Okay, so bankruptcy is kind of interesting, because one of the advantages of bankruptcy is you get a fresh start. One of the disadvantages is the taxing authorities might determine that whatever funds you got that you no longer have to pay back are now income on which you have to pay tax, and tax is non-dischargeable. So that's simply an issue and something you have to consider. When you're dividing assets, you have to worry about who might discharge something in bankruptcy. So I gave an example earlier where I take all the debts to equalize a division
house,
of property.
Right?
That's right. But if I bankrupt out of it, now we truly have an unequal division.
I see.
Okay. So someone got $100,000 cash and I got a $300,000 house and a bankrupt discharge. Now, I'm not a bankruptcy attorney. I do have people in my firm who are, and whether or not someone would qualify or not is something you have to be on alert for. A property owner might not qualify, but might, depending on circumstances.
We're talking with Ethan Marcus, Certified Family Law Specialist. His website, barefootlawyer.com. Now, you'd looked at Jackie's list of 12 there, and you saw a lot of crossover. I think you called it guideline. Is that what you called it?
Yeah. With child support, there's a mandatory statewide guideline. The federal people imposed on all states a requirement that we have a guideline in exchange for federal funds on certain things. We don't have to necessarily pick a particular guideline, and California has one that's unique. But California has guideline deductions, just like the Franchise Tax Board and the IRS have tax deductions. Some deductions are the same, and some are not. And the ones that are not actually work backwards. In other words, if it's a tax deduction, it'll be a guideline addition, and it'll be counted as tax-free income, and it'll actually make your support go up if you're paying it. It'll make your support go down if you're receiving it. So, for example, the number one and number two, healthcare mandates and net investment tax, those are guideline deductions as well as tax deductions. The California College Access Credit is not a guideline deduction, and that's going to create a situation where it'll affect support in a way opposite that it affects the tax issue.
Well, so let's back up for just a second. So in this guideline is in calculating how much support should be paid.
That's right.
Right? And you're highlighting the areas that the tax code and the California guidelines are similar and different.
That's right.
Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, think of the Department of Child Support Services as like the children's IRS.
Okay.
And they have all kinds of codes, just like the IRS or the Franchise Tax Board does. And some deductions will help you and some deductions will not. And that's why you have to navigate the strategy. Do you want to exploit an advantage tax-wise? Because it may backfire on you support-wise.
So, as an example, if I decided to contribute to the California College Access Credit in hopes of reducing my what would be perceived income for the process of determining my spousal support payments, that is not going to do me any good. Is that what you're saying?
It will do you a lot of good in that you will benefit this college access fund.
Okay.
And it will reduce your tax liability.
Okay.
Where it will not do you very much good is it will reduce the cash in your pocket, because you actually, as Jackie pointed out, don't get a dollar for dollar credit. So you're spending more money than you would have spent in taxes. That's number one. And number two, you will also be increasing your support liability if you're paying, or decreasing your support eligibility if you're receiving.
Got it. Okay. So that is one example of where the two differ.
Yeah.
Got it. Maybe at some point in time, the guidelines will pick that up. This is relatively new. Do you find that they line up?
No.
Not over time. They don't merge over time.
Nope. And that's deliberately so.
Oh, really?
That's deliberately so. So if someone is getting the advantage of depreciation, the IRS and the Franchise Tax Board, they love depreciation. They say, look, you bought some equipment and over time its value is diminishing and you're allowed to deduct that. From the guideline perspective, what they're saying is you're sheltering income that you don't have to pay taxes on. Therefore, it's tax-free income and cough up some support, please. Then no, they're not going to merge.
They're not going to merge.
That's going to be deliberate.
Okay. Well, what else you got? Give me another one.
Okay. With regards to, and she hasn't gotten to it yet, but consideration with regard to alternative minimum tax. When calculating guideline, they're always going to pick the most tax beneficial circumstance that they can. So if you pick something that's not as good for you in terms of whether or not you're paying alternative minimum tax or itemizing, they're going to pick whatever is best and calculate your support accordingly. So this is one of those things where you don't have to worry about the guideline. Pick what's best for you.
Got it. Got it. So if I'm deliberately not taking tax advantages in hopes of coming up with a lower spousal support payment, it's not going to work.
Not on that one.
Not on that one anyway. Not on that one. Interesting. I would imagine you don't have a whole lot of people walking in and suggesting they want to do the opposite of what benefits them most from a year-end tax planning perspective, do you?
You know, you would be surprised.
Okay.
Especially people applying for loans.
Oh, yes. Yes. You can't be both. You can't beat the IRS and the loan officer at the same time.
Correct.
You can only beat one or the other. Yep. I see how that goes. Well, good enough. Thank you, Ethan. We're talking with Ethan Marcus, Marcus Family Law Center. He's a certified family law specialist. His website, barefootlawyer.com. That's his website, barefootlawyer.com. When we come back, we'll hear more from Jackie Jarrett, tax accountant with Hamilton Tharp. The website there again, ht2cpa.com. We will start back with AMT, kind of go through that just a little bit, and continue on with our list ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back. We've been talking with Ethan Marcus. Marcus Family Law Center, certified family law specialist. His website, barefootlawyer.com. That's his website, barefootlawyer.com. We're going to shift gears here back to Jackie Jarrett, tax accountant, Hamilton Tharp. 12 tax saving tips you must know before year end. We talked about the first three: healthcare mandates, net investment income tax, and California college access credit. Ethan kind of let the cat out of the bag and jumped us down to number 8, which is AMT, alternative minimum tax. So let's talk about that, Jackie. What does that mean? Why should I care?
Okay, well, I will start with this disclaimer. Alternative minimum tax is one of the most convoluted parts of the tax code.
Wonderful.
Yeah. AMT generally applies to higher income taxpayers. It's an alternate tax calculation, so it really depends on an individual's tax situation. It basically takes your income, it adjusts for certain preference items. State tax payments and real estate tax payments are considered one of the preference items. It's probably one of the biggest things that we look at during year-end tax planning for taxpayers who need to make estimated tax payments mm-hmm. to the state. The fourth quarter payment is due January 15th, although many taxpayers who are not subject to AMT can get a tax benefit if they make that tax payment December 31st. Also, real estate tax payments are due December 10th. Some people choose to pay both installments to kind of accelerate that deduction and take it in 2014.
Well, that's an interesting idea. So, yeah, what is it? I think the acronym is No Darn Fooling Around November, December, February, April, right? So if you make both payments the previous year, which would be 2014 now, mm-hmm. you get the whole deduction this year, huh?
This year.
I never thought of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. And then, of course, next year you're, well, I guess you're forever ahead if you want to keep both.
Yeah. It really depends on what your tax situation is. But if you are subject to AMT, it does not benefit you. So that is one thing. Yeah, that is one thing that we look at. So AMT, it generally applies to high income taxpayers. But I've seen cases where there are married filing joint couple in the $500,000 range where they're not subject to AMT simply because those preference items have not created a higher tax with the AMT. So it's really just an alternate tax calculation to adjust your income for preference items and see, okay, is your AMT tax higher or is your regular tax higher? You pay the greater of the two.
Greater of the two. Okay. Yeah. And so, well, I think really what this is highlighting is, since you were so kind to give us the disclaimer, that this is a very complicated calculation to make. I mean, I think one can probably rudimentary get some idea of what my penalty is for not having my health care in place, right? But mm-hmm. AMT being a very complicated calculation, getting it done ahead of time to understand the implications may give you a better understanding of how much income you want to defer or investments you want to make or pension plan contributions, for example, to make or needed to make to avoid, well, AMT, which would then drop it down to the lower level, whichever is lesser, is what I think you just described, right?
Yes.
Got it. Okay. What's next?
Okay. I would recommend maximizing your retirement plan contributions at this time of year. It's the end of the year. Many employees are receiving bonuses that can be used to make retirement contributions. Maybe you've received a wage increase this year and you're eligible to make more. But 401k employees can make up to $17,500 in 401k contributions. This is all pre-tax, so you will not be taxed on this income, or $23,000 if you're 50 or over. One thing I like to point out, too, traditional IRA contributions, if you're under the limit and you're eligible to make it, $5,500 can be a tax deduction from your regular income, tax-exempt. And you don't have to make that contribution until April 15th. So you don't need to make your IRA contribution by December 31st for it to be deductible. So that's kind of an interesting one. Same with self-employed pension. So depending on what type of retirement vehicle you have, you either need to set up the plan and make the contribution by December 31st, or you can wait till April 15th.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about, on that same tone, let's talk about Roth and IRA conversions. Excuse me, Roth IRA conversions.
Okay.
Start by telling us what a Roth IRA is.
Okay, so a Roth IRA, it's an individual retirement account, but it's funded with after-tax dollars.
Okay.
So with a traditional IRA, you can deduct that from your wages. You're not taxed on that income. The Roth IRA, you make the contribution after you've already paid your taxes.
And you pay no taxes when you come out of that investment.
Correct. So it's a way to kind of shelter your investment earnings. You can make the contribution and have tax-free growth of assets until you take the distributions. When you take the distributions, they're tax-free as well, another benefit. And we kind of skipped over a required minimum distribution, but Roth IRAs do not have a required minimum distribution. The other kind of interesting thing, Roth contributions are limited, so high-income earners can't make contributions to Roth IRAs. However, a change in the law in 2010 eliminated the income limit for converting to a Roth IRA. So this gave high income earners a benefit. They are now able to roll over their traditional IRA to a Roth IRA if they want to have tax-free growth of assets and avoid required minimum distributions in the future.
So if I put money in a traditional IRA, it mm-hmm. is non-taxed money. Mm-hmm. Right, I would roll it to an IRA and pay taxes at that time.
Correct.
When I roll it.
Correct.
And once I rolled it to an IRA, I would have then, it would be post-tax money. Mm-hmm. Let it grow tax-free and receive the income tax-free from that growth.
Yes.
Is that the idea?
Yes. So you want to time your Roth IRA conversion in a low income earning year.
Okay.
So you don't want
to
because you're going to be taxed at the ordinary tax rate. Like you said, you roll over from an IRA to a Roth, it becomes taxable income. So in a low income year, you're going to have a lower tax rate.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. I see what you're saying. We're talking with Jackie Jarrett, tax accountant, Hamilton Tharp. The website, ht2cpa.com, ht2cpa.com.
And then I also wanted to mention there's something called the backdoor Roth, which has become very popular. Many high-income earners benefit from making non-traditional IRA contributions. So non-deductible IRA contributions, if your income is over the limit, you can still contribute to an IRA. You can convert the IRA to a Roth. And all of your non-deductible contributions are considered your basis. So you only take, you only pay taxes on the earnings while it was an IRA. So this is what's referred to as the backdoor Roth.
There's still a way to do it.
Yeah. Just an interesting strategy for high-income earners. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Well, we talked about maximizing retirement plan contributions as well, AMT, charitable contributions. I think we talked about that just a little bit, but let's touch on that one more time.
Okay. Well, taxpayers can generate last-minute deductions by dropping off their non-cash donations to charitable organizations. The holidays are a great time to make extra space in your home by donating items you no longer need or that have been recently replaced. I don't know if it's the first thing that you want to do on December 26th, but it is a good way to get a last-minute tax deduction. The Salvation Army has an excellent list that kind of indicates what the fair market value of your different donated items are. So it's recommended to get a receipt, kind of have an itemization of what was donated, establish what the fair market value is, and there's your deduction. Last-minute cash donations can also be made by charging your charitable donation to a credit card. So get the deduction in 2014, even if you don't pay your credit card bill until 2015.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Get the kids involved. What does that mean?
Yes. So if you are a business owner, you might want to consider employing your children. Generally, wages paid to children are exempt from certain employer payroll taxes. Unlike regular employees, you need to pay the payroll taxes. But if they're your children, there are certain payroll taxes that you can avoid. Also, wages paid to children are taxed at a lower rate than their parents. So it's a way of transferring the income and reducing an overall tax rate. My only caution here is to make sure that if you employ this strategy, it's executed properly. Children must actually perform services for the company.
Okay.
I recommend creating a timesheet to keep track of the hours worked. And then the exemption from certain payroll taxes is different for children under the age of 18 versus children under the age of 21. So parents using this strategy will just want to make sure they're in compliance with federal and state tax reporting and withholding requirements, if any, to avoid any notices and penalties.
Wow. We're talking with Jackie Jarrett, tax accountant with Hamilton Tharp. Their website, HT2CPA. We talked about the 12 tax saving tips you must know before year end. Talked, got through about 8 of them or so. So there's time itemized deduction, consideration of required minimum distribution, expiration of bonus depreciation, optimized security transactions. They're out there. There's more information. The website, HT2CPA.com. That's the website, HT2CPA.com. Jackie Jarrett, tax accountant. We also spoke with Ethan Marcus, certified family law specialist. His website, barefootlawyer.com. That's his website, barefootlawyer.com. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Ryan. It's always a pleasure.
Until next week.